Thank you. days with a cavity organ. 'Twas a year ago last summer he rode up to the herd. Just a little Texas strain all alone. Well, he left his home in Texas, his Maud married twice, and his old pa beat him every day or two. So he saddled up old Chaw one night and lit a shuck this way. Thought he'd try and paddle now his own canoe. Well, with his broken shoes and overhauls, a tougher looking kid you never in your life had seen before. His hot roll in a cotton sack was loosely tied behind, and a canteen from the saddle horn was slung. Well, he's looking for a job, but he didn't know straight up about no cow. But the boss kinda liked him and cuts him out a mount, 'cause he sorta liked that little stray somehow. Taught him how to herd the horses and to know them all by name, and to get him up by daylight if he could, and to load the chuck wagon and to always hitch the team, and to help the old cookie rustle wood. Well, we was camped down in Red River and the weather, she was fine. We was setting on the north side in a bend when a norther commenced blowing, and we doubles up our guard, 'cause it took all hands to hold them cattle then. Now little Joe the wrangler just called out with the rest, and hardly had that kid got to the herd when them cattle they stampeded like a hailstorm long they flew, and all of us was riding for the lead. Between the streaks of lightning we could see the horse there out ahead. It was little Joe the wrangler in the lead. He was riding old Blue Rocket with his slicker around his head, trying to check them lead cows in their speed. Well, we got them kind of milling and sort of quieted down, and the extra guard back to the camp did go. But one of them was missing, and we all saw at a glance 'twas our little lost horse herder, Jangler Joe. Well, next morning, just at sunup, we found where a rocket fell down in a washout 40 foot below. Beneath his horse smashed to a pulp, his spurs had rung the knell for our little lost horse herder, Wrangler Joe. And I was wasting my time, I was out of a job and I ain't got a dime, when old Sid steps up and he says, I suppose, but you're a bronc fighter by the rig of your clothes. Well, you guesses me right, that's my middle name. Have you got any bad ones you're aiming to tame? He says, I've got one, she's a bad one to buck, and at losing good riders he's had lots of luck. So I gets all excited and asks what he pays if I fight that old horse for a couple of days. He says, I'll pay 10, and I says, I'm your man, 'cause there ain't a bronc in this land I can't find. So he says, get your saddle, I'll give you a chance. And we hops in the buckboard and builds to the ranch. It was early next morning and right after chuck. I'm hankering to see how that bad horse can buck. Well, it's out in the horse corral, standing alone, where a little old horse just a strawberry roan. He, his legs is all spavin, and he had pigeon toes, had little pig eyes, and had a big Roman nose. He was ewe-necked and old, with a long lower jaw. You could see at one glance he was a real outlaw. Well, I put on my spurs and I pick up my twine. I pull down my hat down, I'm sure feeling fine. Then I throws the loop on him, and well, I know then that before I get aboard him, I'll sure earn my tin. Well, first comes the blinds and I puts them on tight. Next comes my saddle, and it sure was a fight. Then I steps aboard him, and I pulls off the blinds, and I takes a deep seat for to watch him unwind. He goes up in the east, he come down in the west. To stay in his middle, I'm doing my best. He sure is frog walking, he heaves a big sigh. He only likes wings for to be on the fly. I feel like I'm riding a hurricane deck of a cyclone and tornado having a wreck. Well, he's the worst bucker I've seen on the range. He'll light on a nickel, boys, and give you the change. His backbone's a mountain, his legs stiff as poles. When he hits the ground, boys, he digs 10-foot holes. And it's right on the top of each stiff-legged buck that he sucks himself back and you're riding on luck. Well, he bogs his old head right atwixt his hind feet, and he kicks up his heels and he turns on the heat. He turns his old belly right up to the sun. He sure is a sunfishing son of a gun. He burns his old tail right against that old sun. He says, hold on, cowboy, and I'll show you some fun. Then he takes a big jump and he spins at the top. And I asks him politely, oh, horse, won't you stop? Then he heads right straight up, and he don't turn around like he's done give up life way down there on the ground. Well, he heads for the North Pole, and he ends at the South. He's swapping in so fast that his tail's in his mouth. My reins is all busted, and the bits hanging loose. My saddle is slipping back on his caboose. Then he turns inside out, and he swallows his hide, and that was the end, boys, of my $10 ride.
Harry, you don't mean that a cowboy does...
Mighty split-second decisions about all kinds of things. You've got to be able to assist, be a midwife at the birth of a 1,000-odd calves, sometimes in 20 below zero weather, and you've got to know how to... you've got to know how to shoe horses. You've got 5 to 6, 7 horses that are your string, and you've got to shoe those horses. There's nobody around to shoe those horses for you. Even when you're back at the main cow camp, to this day, every cowboy shoes his own horses. You don't have anybody else shoeing his horses.
You've got a rope, too, don't you?
Yeah, you've got to handle a rope. And there are top ropers on outfits, just like there are top bronc riders. But every cowboy's got to handle a rope. Because if a cow is sick out on the range somewhere, or a calf, a yearling, or a bull is sick, and you've got to nurse this animal, well, you've got to take your rope down and catch this animal and spread him out. Or branding, you've got to catch the calves. Every calf's got to be caught by the rope.
And then there are these cattle drives, I suppose. Are they still used today?
Oh, sure. They're used a great deal to go from winter range to summer range. They're not the long drives of the old trail days, the Chisholm Trail and what have you, the Goodnight Trail, but we still have cattle drives, and you've got to know how to handle animals. All this yelling you hear about cowboys, you hear all this hooping and hollering like I've been doing on here, but really, on a trail drive, you've got to know exactly when to let out a yell, and you've got to be able to let out a good one if you've got to. But most of the time, you get fired if you let out a yell like that, because you'll be running the beef off the animals, they'll say. So you've got to just go along, and you'll hear noises like, you know, or like that, or man just slapping his chaps, his leather pants, you know, and that's all you'll need to move the stock to spook them. And let me sing you a old trail driving song that's got a lot of yells in it. You get fired for singing it, on the drive usually. But let's see.
As I went walking one morning for the pleasure, I spied a cowpuncher riding alone. His hat was thrown back and his spurs was a-jangling. And as I approached the boy, he was singing this song. Little dogies, she's yours, fortune ain't none of my own. get on, little dogies, you know that Wyoming 'twill be your new home. Now some boys go up that trail for pleasure, but that's where they get her decidedly wrong. They don't know all the trouble they cause us as we ride in the drags and we tail them along. Yee-ha! Ha! Get on, little dogies. It's your misfortune, ain't none of my own. Yee-ha! Ha! Ha! Get on there. Yeah, come on. Get on, little dogies. You know that Wyoming could be your new home.
Harry, when you come off a cattle drive or a couple of weeks on the range, I suppose the first thing you do is get drunk and then maybe look up the girls. What else is there for recreation?
Well, I guess just go and do it again. Get drunk again. And what you do very often is certainly you drink and fool around a little bit until you've just about got nothing left, no money. And then you go to the movies and see a cowboy film. That's the thing to do, is they go and watch some more riding and roping and cowboy singing and riding off into the sunset, and meanwhile back at the ranch and all that kind of thing.
Well, you said cowboy singing, but this would be country western singing in a movie, and has that had any influence on the cowboy singing tradition itself?
Oh, yes, it has. It's had a lot of influence. Country western jukebox songs, and Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and all those guys have given 1,000 songs to cowboys. A lot of them don't stick, and then some of them do. I mean, like Tumbling Tumbleweed, that's just about straight up pure western song. No, people forgot where it came from, I think. All cowboys kind of know snatches, little bits and snatches of that. Or songs like When It's Roundup Time in Texas is one.
Well, what about Deep in the Heart of Texas? I've heard that.
Oh, yeah, well, that's very funny. Deep in the Heart of Texas, I remember when that came out, we took that song and we used it as the starting point to make our own little song up in my part of the country. There was a little kind of business going on there amongst one of the cowboys and one of the girls in the neighborhood. And there was some trouble because her father was going to shoot him if he caught him around his daughter, and we wrote this song about it. We just made it up, and then the cowboy's name, I remember, was Harry Nevins, and he was going to get shot.
You may get shot before.
Yeah, that's all right. No. I'm sure wherever Harry is, he understands. But the thing is that it's that many years ago. But,
well, Harry, what you're really stressing here, I think, as much as anything, is the fact that this, like other occupations which have survived down to the present time, have been heavily influenced by our commercial literature and all of that kind of thing. The cowboy now takes a transistor radio out on the range. He has helicopters and jeeps helping him in his work. But I suppose that one point really remains, and that is the relationship between the man and the horse and the cattle. That won't change.
No, I don't think that'll change very much. I mean, you still need horses to work cattle, and you've got to have men that can handle horses and cattle. But there's one thing I think that you leave out, a very important thing that you leave out of the equation there, men and horses and cattle, and that is a tremendous amount of courage. And a kind of code, which I can't really describe or analyze, but it does exist. And without that, you wouldn't have the cattle industry or the cowboy.
Well, Harry, that code is, of course, not the code that's depicted in The Lone Ranger. It maybe has some of that element in it, but it's a code that probably is best summed up in a song like Utah Carol. And
yes, it is.
I think if the people will listen to the lyrics of Utah Carol, then they will really have some idea of that code.
That's a hell of a long song, Chris.
Well, I know it's a long song, Harry, but I also know it's one of your favorites. And then it does make this point about the code and the courage of the cowboy probably as well as any song that there is. So why don't you just sing the final stanzas where the story does concentrate on this code? Now, the Ballad of Utah Carol was supposedly written by a cowhand on the Curve T Ranch in Schleicher County, Texas. It tells about a little girl whose saddle blanket slips, and she falls down in front of a stampede. She's going to be killed, but Utah Carol comes to the rescue.
Many times from out of the saddle, he'd caught hold of the trailing rope. And now to catch her at full speed, it was the child's only hope. While leaning out of his saddle and catching her up in his arms, he thought he had been successful and saved that child from harm. But the weight upon them cinches had never been felt there before. So the ladder goes burst asunder, and he lay beside Lenore. Then Utah picks up that blanket, and a-waving it over his head. Lay still, Lenore, I'll save you, was the words my partner said. When Utah grabs that blanket, every cowboy gives a cry. For they knew, though he had saved her, that he was bound to die. But he was bound to die fighting like all brave cowboys do. So quick from out of his scabbard, Utah Carol his pistol he drew. Them critters, they was on him, but he dropped that lead most dear. That pistol cracked like lightning, the report rang loud and clear. When we broke into the circle, we knew his life it was o'er. But still we could hear him murmuring, lay still, I'll save you, Lenore.
Than your poor hands can hold. If you only let your hair hang down, Albert, is your
more than your poor. played is not a theme consisting of 12 different tones. It's merely a skeletal framework out of which the composer may evolve as many different versions as his fancy dictates. To simplify, I'll just use the first 6 tones instead of all 12 tones, like this. Schoenberg suggested 3 other possible arrangements derived from this basic role, all 3 based on classical procedures. The first is to read the 12-tone role backwards, like you'd read a sentence backwards. The second derivation treats the role by inversion in this way. In the third derivation, the inversion of the role is itself read backwards, like this.
Thank you.
Two more, which are rather similar in general effect. The tone and atmosphere of the piece is very different from the romantic expressivity of Berg or Schoenberg, and it's because of this that one gets the sense of hearing a truly new kind of music.
Thank you.
Was Anton Webern's quartet Opus 22. Webern has become an influence on the younger generation to a degree that none of us who first knew his music in the 20s could possibly have imagined.
How hesitant and diffident I was that first morning when I was about to address myself to the string bean vine, so that the switch from peas to string beans was also a frightening thing there. And by some effort there, see, I could live myself into this experience of change, the frightening thing of it. You could almost say that broken habits, you know, are as disturbing, as upsetting as broken hearts, broken spirits, see. And I worked, you know, I worked on this, the ordeal of change, developing all these theories there, see. And the theories of change, I tried to show that when a population is subjected to drastic change, you are actually getting a population of misfits. See? Because we cannot prepare ourselves, you know, for the wholly new, for the unprecedented. So inevitably, see, the moment any country is subjected to drastic change, you have misfits. See? And once you have misfits, they will act and perform only in an atmosphere of passion. Of course, the very fact that these nations are unskilled also generates heat, generates fever, fervor, generates heat again. Now, in other words, the passionate state of mind, Mr. Day, is a substitute for skill. It's a substitute for confidence. You can see it on the waterfront. You take, for instance, an experienced longshoreman. He goes about his job as if at play. On the other hand, you take a greenhorn, a man who just come there, we call him a cherry there. See, he has to move around and do things as if he was going to save the world, if he's going to do anything at all. So this too is a factor. And then again, you have the countries are poor, you know. In other words, they can't pay people, you know. They can't offer people tangible incentives to make them work, see? And therefore they have to make them work for words. They have to make them work for hope, for pride, for honor, and all these things there. And all these makes it necessary, you know, that makes it impossible, let's say, for those nations to perform at room temperature. They need enthusiasm. They need fervor. And Mr. Day, only after I finished that ordeal of change did I realize that all this time, you know, I was actually developing and amending The True Believer, the book on mass wounds. Imagine. Here I wrote the book of mass wounds. I've been thinking about the subject for almost 20 years. And it never occurred to me that change by itself is a cause of mass movement. In The True Believer, all I say is that the revolutions are instruments, you know, for the realization of drastic change. It never occurred to me that there cannot be no mass movement, you know, where there hasn't occurred change, where things haven't changed at all, revolutions don't take place at all. Change comes first, and the revolution is a byproduct of change. So, after all this thing was done, I realized that I was still writing The True Believer. Well, when all this was done, I became all of a sudden interested in another subject. You see, I'm actually convinced now that no matter what my new interest is going to be, I'll be still working on The True Believer. Even if I get interested in cooking or astronomy, The True Believer is pushing out. This is a fantastic thing to me. I mean, this growth, this train of thought that it's coming out, it's trying to get out there, no matter what I do. Now here, several years ago, I became interested, of all things, in juveniles. Can you beat that? Me, a man in his 60s, who is naturally hostile to juveniles, at least hostile, I hardly ever meet them. You know, all I know about juveniles is what you read in the papers there. See? And judging by the papers, the juveniles are awful, you know. And here, all of a sudden, I became interested in juveniles. Now, how did it happen? It's really fantastic, you know. You remember, Mr. Day, several years ago, there was a week during which the newspapers reported an epidemic of student riots.
Yes.
Starting in Istanbul, coming over to Tehran, then down to, I think it was Bangkok, and then you had Saigon, then you had Seoul, Tokyo, and it wound up in Mexico City, I think. And most of these student riots had an anti-American bias. And I remember one morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, as I was waiting for the bus, I saw the headline in the newspaper announcing one more student riot. And I remember I snorted and I said, bah, I said, history made by juvenile delinquents. And the moment the words came out of my mouth, Mr. Day, something clicked in my mind. Now, this click is not very frequent, but it's often enough that when I hear that click, see, I know that I'm plugged in, you know, that something connected in my mind. So I bought the paper and I got in the bus, but when I sat down the bus, I didn't look at the paper at all, you know. Things were coming together in my mind. Things I've read over the years, stray observations and experiences, and even thoughts that I formulated long ago.
That didn't fit in.
But I ask myself, who is making history? Is it the old who are making history? What role do the young play in making history? And I remembered, like I said, look, when I wrote The Passionate State of Mind, for some reason, I inserted an aphorism which reads like this. History is made by men who have the restlessness, impressionability, credulity, capacity for make-believe, ruthlessness, and self-righteousness of children. It's made by men who set their hearts on toys. All leaders strive to turn their followers into children. Now, this insight came to me from observing two willful godchildren in action, you know, and of course observing the antics of the Nazis and the communists. But the thought was filed away in my mind. It didn't integrate with any train of thought, but now I had a hunch that it should be almost easy for me, you know, to make out a case that one can hardly know how things happened in history unless you keep in mind all the time that it's juveniles, that most of the time it's juveniles that made them happen. And I started to collect the facts. Well, you know, Mr. Day, that despite the psalmist 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90, 100, 70, 80, 90 know, the truly old are a very rare phenomenon in history. I read about the excavation of one of the most ancient cemeteries in the Near East. And the archaeologists found that the people who were buried there, were, the average age of the people buried there was 25 years old at death. And there is no reason to believe that that the place was particularly unhealthy. But this means a tremendous thing. It means that the great inventions of the Neolithic age, you know, the domestication of animals and plants, the invention of the wheel, sail, irrigation, fermentation, even the calendar and the script was made by almost a childlike population. And you remember in the Ordeal of Change, I have a whole chapter on the playful mood suggesting that this is actually how those inventions were made. Then I thought to myself, these ancient legends too, you know, with their fairy-tale-like pattern and their heavy sexual symbolism wasn't written by burnt-out old men, you know. But even more recent periods could hardly be understood unless you kept in mind that the chief characters, the chief protagonists of those periods were actually juveniles. Now, for instance, anytime you go to the Young Museum and you look at the armor, you know, the suits of mail that came down to us from the Middle Ages. Now, the thing that strikes you is that how small these things are, and you are convinced that that the people who wore them were not grown up persons, and indeed they weren't. You know, these people became men at the age of 13. I mean, they married at the age of 13. They became generals and leaders in their teens, and they were old men at 30 and 35. You know, the Middle Ages were a very poor time for the middle aged. The troubadours and the historians make a tremendous fun, you know, of all the middle aged. And unless you keep in mind, you know, unless you know something about juveniles and juvenile and the pattern of juvenile delinquency, you could hardly make sense of those, of the flamboyance, the pageantry, the credulity, the